This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, actor James Franco, has a big night a week from Sunday. He's co-hosting the Academy Awards ceremony, and he's nominated for Best Actor for his performance in the film 127 Hours. But Franco's a guy who likes to stay busy. He played a young Allen Ginsberg in the recent film Howl. He's been studying art, film, and writing at places including Yale University and Rhode Island School of Design. And last fall, he published a collection of short stories. Franco got his start on the TV series Freaks and Geeks. He co-starred in Spider-Man, starred with Seth Rogen in the comedy Pineapple Express, and in the movie Milk, he played Harvey Milk's boyfriend. 127 Hours, directed by Danny Boyle, who made Slumdog Millionaire, is based on the true story of a hiker who's trapped for days after his arm is pinned under a boulder. In a gruesome sequence, the film shows how he amputates his own arm to free himself. Terry spoke to James Franco in October.
Why did you want to put yourself through the kind of agony, mental agony, that you'd have to experience acting this role?
You know, I actually was very attracted to the challenge of doing a movie that, you know, involved being isolated for all that that time, and it was unique, not only because I don't work with, you know, for most of the movie I'm not working opposite other actors, but I'm in one spot, and so it's not even like Castaway where he had that whole island to walk around on. Like I'm just in this canyon and I can't move. And on paper, and especially, you know, working on a project like this with Danny Boyle, it all sounds, you know, really great and like, you know, a exciting kind of new kind of filmmaking. But that doesn't necessarily translate into a movie that people want to go and watch. And so, and I was aware of that, and Danny was certainly aware of that. And that was kind of the challenge that he wanted to take on. You know, and as if you know his films, they're not slow films. They all have pace. They all have great energy. And he's very interested in making movies that are full of life. I guess, you know, the making of the movie was really, you know, a case of Danny and I and the DPs and the writer and everyone, you know, really working together to make this very static situation into something incredibly dynamic. And
I've read reviews that say, yes, it's he's
it is
pinned by this boulder, but it's really very entertaining.
It's a very unique film experience.
Oh, here's what I want to know. Like, what is it like to wake up every morning when you're shooting the film and say, what's ahead of me today? Oh, yes, pain. I endure a lot more pain.
Well, I didn't think I would go crazy. Danny kept warning me before we did it. He's like, yeah, James, you're going to go crazy. I think he wanted to prepare me, but yeah, he'd say, yeah, James, I think you're going to go a little crazy in this canyon. And he prepared for that in some ways. You know, we had it was an incredibly fast shoot. I worked 6-day weeks. Danny worked 7-day weeks for 2 months because there were two DPs. And so Danny would just, you know, switch between the crews. And I think Danny designed it that way because he knew not only would I go a little crazy, the whole crew would go a little crazy just working under those conditions. But on one hand, I had an incredible experience because I was working with Danny Boyle, you know, and then these two incredible DPs, Anthony Don Mantle and Kike Chediak. And so I was working with, you know, all these guys that I loved, and I had a great relationship with all of them. But yeah, I was stuck in, you know, we shot a lot of it on a set, but the set was not like a normal set. You know, usually if you shoot on a stage, you build a set so that it can be taken apart, so, you know, cameras can move in for different angles that, you know, you normally wouldn't get on at a real location. But they didn't build the set this way. They built it so that it couldn't come apart. And so really, I was isolated every day in this set, and the way that it kind of worked out, a lot of times it was easier to just stay in the set while they, you know, would change the camera setups. And so for the first month of shooting, I didn't see half of the crew. I really just saw the DPs, and because they operated the cameras, and then heard Danny's voice over this little speaker that they built into the wall of the canyon. And it kind of did drive me a little crazy. I think one of the things that saved me was I was still in school at the time, and so I had all this reading I had to do for school, so I'd bring my books and stash them under the boulder. And and then between setups, I would read my books, and I think that helped me a little bit.
So what's the difference between what you saw when you were cutting off your arm in the film and what is actually in the film, what you see when you see yourself in the film?
What do you mean? Like
when you were doing the shoot and you were amputating your arm, what's the difference between what you saw on the set and what we see in the film?
Well, obviously I didn't really cut my arm off, although there were some scenes where, you know, the character tries it. He makes many attempts to cut his arm off and do various things to get out. And in some of the takes, Danny asked me to just kind of saw at my arm with a dull blade, like that, you know, because the character, that was the thing is, you know, Aaron had a knife, but it was dull because he had never used a knife before. He never had needed it before. And so he never even thought to sharpen it. And so there were times when he attempted to saw his arm off with the dull blade, and Danny said, "Well, why don't you just try and do it?" And so there were times when I was doing it on my own arm, and that led to, you know, some minor permanent damage, because, you know, they built, you know, these great effects guys, they built this arm that had all the, you know, musculature inside and vein, you know, all the veins were in place and nerves, and so I really could just go at it. And the way we shot it is, you know, we did like these 20-minute takes for, you know, and we did that throughout the movie. You know, we do these very, very long takes. And so we did that for the amputation scene. And so I was just cutting away and, you know, the arm was going through. And I actually, Danny told me afterwards that the effects guy was saying to him, you know, whispering Danny's ear, like, you know, he's not going to be able to make it all the way through. You know, there are certain things in there that are, you know, going to prevent him from cutting all the way through. So I actually did. I went all the way through and I surprised him and everyone. And I actually, the first time I went through the arm, I fell back and, you know, fell on my back, but, on my butt. And, so I actually made it through. And, I think part of that take is in the film.
So is it horrifying to watch yourself actually amputate your arm on screen?
I thought that I would have more trouble with it. I've actually recently just watched back a documentary that a friend of mine from NYU made about the filming process. She was there for the whole thing, and she has this scene in it where I actually have just got into the part of, you know, the actual cutting, and I say to Danny, gosh, I'm getting a little lightheaded. I think you're getting very genuine reactions because all this fake blood and you know, this prosthetic arm is so real. It's making me lightheaded. So I guess it was realistic enough, looked realistic enough that it was having, I was having psychosomatic reactions to it. And
when you were filming it.
Yeah, when we were actually filming it. And so, you know, in some screenings, people actually applaud at that moment. And I've never experienced like anything like that in a movie, like in the middle of the movie, like they're applauding. So it's a difficult thing to watch, but it's also something that I think people want to watch because you've gone down the road with this guy so far that you want him to get out.
James Franco speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview recorded in October with actor James Franco. Last year, he played a young Allen Ginsberg in the film Howl, named after Ginsberg's first published poem. It was a groundbreaking work that evoked Walt Whitman, but with the stories, language, and rhythms of what became known as beat poetry. Here's Franco from the opening of the film, playing Ginsberg reading the first lines of Howl in his first public reading at the Six Gallery.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities.
That's James Franco portraying Allen Ginsberg in the new film Howl, and in that scene he's reading an excerpt of Howl. Well done.
Thank
I mean, there's no film here unless you can convincingly get Allen Ginsberg's cadences, because so much of the film revolves around you reading the poem Howl. So what was it about Allen Ginsberg's voice that really stuck out to you, that made you think, okay, this is what the voice is, this is what I built the voice around?
I guess, you know, he has a bit of a New Jersey accent. I guess that's what it is, or, you know, it's a kind of an East Coast thing. And there is a alternation. He alternates between kind of great exuberance and, I guess, you know, this kind of sympathetic tone, you know, depending on what section he's reading. And so I tried to find out how he would be responding to each section and then, you know, deliver it accordingly.
How familiar were you with Allen Ginsberg's poems before preparing to make the movie?
I was pretty familiar. I'd read a fair amount of them when I was younger. It seems that people of a certain age, young people, especially young men, usually come across the Beats, and I and my friends certainly did. And so
what did it mean to you when you read them?
Well, it's funny. I'm actually in a class right now at Yale where we're it's about the Beats and about literary coterie. So it's about the Beats and about McSweeney's and Dave Eggers. But so I'm rereading all of those books that I read for the first time when I was in high school, and I think what really struck me was how, you know, there were these young guys and they were, you know, looking for a new way of writing. Most of them had gone to Columbia or some other Ivy Leagues, and they had great teachers, but they were trying to break away from what they had learned in school and were looking for new ways. And they really had no models, so they were just supporting each other and encouraging each other. And that's how they made it. That's how they found this these new ideas. And so I think that was really inspiring for me as a young man, and that idea of just the search and having, you know, artistic friends around that could support me, and maybe that would be enough.
So your part in the movie alternates between reading the poem Howl and being interviewed. And we don't see your interviewer. You're there alone on screen talking into a reel-to-reel tape machine as the interview is being recorded. So is this gathered from different transcripts of interviews, or is this based on one interview with Ginsberg?
Yeah, so I guess there was a lost interview that he gave to Time, I think back in the 60s, and Ginsberg had been in Tangiers, and they flew him out to Rome, and he gave this interview, and it was lost. They didn't, I guess it was too racy, and they never published it. And no transcripts exist, but Epstein and Friedman decided that they were going to use that idea for this interview, and it would be the lost interview. But the way that they created this interview was they compiled, bits from interviews that Ginsberg had given his entire life. Everything that I say in those interviews, you know, everything that's said in the courtroom scenes, all of those are based on, you know, things that people actually said.
Okay, so I want to play an excerpt of the interview. And this is him talking about something that happened between him and his therapist that changed his life. Mm-hmm. So here's my guest, James Franco, in a scene from Howl in which he's being interviewed.
In San Francisco, I had a year of psychotherapy with Dr. Hicks. I was blocked because I couldn't write. I was still trying to act normal. I was
afraid I was crazy. I was sure that I was supposed to be heterosexual and that something was wrong with me. And Dr. Hicks kept saying, what do you want to do? What is your heart's desire? So finally I said, well, what I'd really like to do is to just quit all this and get a small room with Peter and devote myself to my writing and contemplation and smoking pot and doing whatever I wanted. And he said, why don't you do it then? Well, I mean, what will happen if I grow old and I have pee stains in my underwear and I'm living in some furnished room and nobody loves me and I'm white-haired and have no money and breadcrumbs are falling on the floor? And he said, don't worry about that. You're very charming and lovable and people will always love you. What a relief to hear that. I very soon realized that it was all a fear trap. Illusory.
James Franco as Allen Ginsberg in an excerpt of the new film Howl. So we've talked a little bit about getting the voice for Allen Ginsberg. What did you do to try to look like him? Because you're not the first person who comes to mind when you think of what Allen Ginsberg looked like. And most of us, when we think of what Allen Ginsberg looked like, think of him in his later years as opposed to when he was in his 20s, because he wasn't as visible then. I mean, you got the glasses. You got his trademark glasses from
yes,
that period.
Yes, that was key. Well,
did that help, having the glasses?
It certainly helped. Well, I had a similar reaction when they asked me to do it. Actually, Gus Van Sant was the first person to bring the project to my attention. I was in the middle of filming Milk with Gus, and Gus is an executive producer on Howl, and he said, You know, I knew Rob and Jeff because they had, you know, worked on the documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk, which, you know, we all watched to prepare for Milk. And so I knew who they were. And Gus said, you know, they have a movie about Allen Ginsberg and they want you to play Allen. And I thought, really? Because, you know, I like I said, I loved the Beats. I had been reading them since I was about 15. And ever since I got into acting, I always dreamed about, you know, doing a movie about the Beats. But I never thought that I would play Allen. I always thought, well, sure, I'll be Kerouac or Cassidy. But I was being offered Allen. And so I thought, well, will I be of service to this movie playing Allen? I mean, can I really do that? And so I did. You know, I went back and looked at some of the photographs of young Allen, and then I thought, well, it's not that far. You know, young Allen, most people think, you know, when they think of Ginsberg, they think of the older Ginsberg, the heavier and balder and bearded Ginsberg. And that would have been a stretch. But the younger Ginsberg is actually kind of close to my build. We have similar, you know, coloring, and he had hair. And And by coincidence, I was hosting Saturday Night Live at the time, and they had just won an Emmy for makeup. So I brought in a picture of young Ginsberg. I brought it to the makeup department, and I said, "Yeah, you guys, you know, make people look like other people all the time. Well, how would you, if I was going to do a sketch on SNL about Ginsberg, how would you make me look like this?" And they said, "Well, actually, it's not that hard. You just kind of comb your hair over, and you definitely need the glasses. His ears stick out a little bit more than yours, so they kind of push my ears out, and it was like, oh, voila, it was almost enough, and so I told Rob and Jeff about the ear thing, and so for half of the movie we didn't have any prosthetic built at that time, so we just put like some weird Play-Doh behind my ears and stuck them out, and that was kind of it. I mean, I had to get the mannerisms down, but the look was pretty good.
You've been making these movies while studying at Columbia, NYU, Brooklyn College. Now you're studying in two places, the Rhode Island School of Design and Yale. It's like the college version of extreme sports or something. Do you know what I mean? You're doing like so many different colleges. How come so many?
Well, now I kind of narrowed it down. It's not that the schedule isn't quite like that right now. But yeah, the past 2 years I was at a lot of places, and I guess I just thought, you know, I am a little, I have a addictive personality, and
do you?
Yeah, I think I do. So if there's something I like, it's hard for me to, you know, say to not engage with it fully, and to the point of doing, you know, physical harm to myself or whatever, or mental harm. But on the other hand, I loved it, and I was, you know, by going to all those places, I got to work with, you know, all of my favorite writers, and, you know, I got to work with great filmmakers, and, you know, do projects that I'm very, very, very proud of.
James Franco speaking with Terry Gross last year. His film Howl is now out on DVD. A week from Sunday, Franco will be co-hosting the Academy Awards ceremony, where he'll be on hand to see if he wins the Best Actor Award for his performance in the film 127 Hours. And he'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, and for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview recorded last year with actor James Franco. He's co-hosting the Oscar ceremony this year, and he's nominated for Best Actor for his performance in the film 127 Hours. Among his many roles, Franco has a recurring part on the ABC soap opera General Hospital. Here's a clip from the show where he plays a strange artist named Franco.
Cut your hair. You hurt yourself. You okay?
What are you doing here?
Well, I just came to deliver the last 6 roses. I see you put the other 60 in a vase. Nice display, very artistic.
What do you want?
I'm very fond of the number 66. I just like saying it. 66. Sounds dirty.
Why would you send these flowers to me?
You and I spent some very special time together. I hope you haven't forgotten.
No, of course not.
I told you I'd think about you. And I have. Now I know you want to be loyal to your boyfriend, and I respect that. Loyalty's hard to come by these days. I just hope that our performance didn't damage your relationship.
So I'm afraid we're going to run out of time soon, and I want to be able to ask you about the time that you spent acting on General Hospital, which was such a surprise to everybody. You're such a good actor, and I think a very serious actor, even though you've done comedies. You've done them really well, so I consider that part of serious acting. And not to cast aspersions on soap operas, but it's just a different style, you know. So why did you want to do an afternoon soap, and was it their idea or your idea to do this?
Oh, it was my idea. And, you know, I mean, yeah, people can look, you know, often look down on soap operas as inferior kind of entertainment, but I was thinking in a different way at that point. I just read this book by this guy named Carl Wilson, who has since become a friend of mine, and he wrote this book about Celine Dion, and he, you know, wasn't a fan of Celine's, but he decided that he was going to investigate why does he feel superior to Celine's music, and he didn't come to any definite conclusions, but he figured out that, well, Celine's music, it means something to some people and gives a lot of people, I don't know, strength, hope, or whatever you get from music, but it's working for some people. And so he decided to suspend his judgment and stop looking down on Celine just because she doesn't speak to him. And so that's kind of the mindset I was in at that time. And I thought, well, why not? I'll just try being on the soap opera. And so my manager represents Steve Burton, who's one of the stars of General Hospital. And so he had some connections to General Hospital, and he called them up and said that I wanted to be on the show. And They were very excited, to say the least. And they called me up and they said, James, it's so great. You want to be on the soap opera? What do you want to do? You can do whatever you like. So I said, I wanted the character to be an artist, and I wanted him to be crazy. And that's what I told them. And I wanted their version of that. And they gave me the best. I mean, they gave me more than I could have asked for.
So tell me something that you learned from acting on an afternoon soap opera.
So, yeah. So then there was just the pure experience of acting on a soap opera that was also extremely interesting. They have to, you know, you go through material a lot quicker on a soap opera. But not only that, I was still in school. And so I had to do even more material than they normally do in a single day, because they would do all my material on one day a week. I guess it was on Fridays. And I guess they started calling it Franco Fridays, because I'd fly in from New York. I'd wake up at like 4:30, go to the airport, land in LA at about 10:30, go to the studio, and then we'd work for like 12 to 14 hours until, you know, about 2 in the morning. And I would do about, I guess, 70 to 80 pages of material a day. And usually they only, if they get it, they'll only do one take. But that's not just, it's not just one take per setup. They have four cameras going. So that means one take per scene. So you just learn the lines, do it, boom, on to the next scene. So it's a really, it's kind of exhilarating if you get into the pace of it.
Kind of like theater, almost.
Yeah.
Like you're on live, yeah.
It's very close to how they would do the old, like Playhouse 90 theater, you know, television shows in a way.
So just one more thing. Do you have insomnia, and do you use those hours to just keep working?
I mean,
is your day longer than mine?
I don't have insomnia.
Yeah.
As you can see on TMZ, I can sleep anywhere. And I really can sleep anywhere, although now I'm much more wary about sleeping in public, because I'm sure another picture of me will bring a lot of sleeping is will bring a lot of money.
There's a picture of you sleeping in class, which is, I think, what you're referring to.
Yeah. It's actually not class. It's a late night lecture, an optional lecture at the art school that I was not required to be at. So I wasn't, sleeping in class or wasting my opportunity in class. I was at an optional thing, so I think I had every right to sleep in that if I wanted to. I can sleep anywhere. I just have a lot to do, so I tend not to sleep.
James Franco, it's been great to talk with you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Actor James Franco speaking with Terry Gross in October. Franco's co-hosting the Academy Awards presentation, and he's nominated for Best Actor for his performance in the film 127 Hours. The film The King's Speech is nominated for 12 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for the performance of Colin Firth. He plays King George VI of England, who came to the throne in 1936 and suffered from an embarrassing stutter. His efforts to overcome the impediment with the help of an innovative speech therapist is at the center of the film, which is directed by my guest, Tom Hooper. The film was written by David Seidler, who suffered from a stammer himself and took heart as a child listening to King George's radio addresses. Seidler became a successful screenwriter and dreamed of writing about the king. Eventually, he tracked down the handwritten diary of the king's speech therapist, Lionel Logue. Much of the scenes between King George and Logue are based on this diary. Director Tom Hooper won an Emmy for his work on the HBO miniseries Elizabeth I, starring Helen Mirren. He also directed the miniseries John Adams. Among his other films are Longford and The Damned United. I spoke with him in November. Well, Tom Hooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Dave.
This film, The King's Speech, this is one of these films where we don't have to worry about giving away the story. I mean, it's fairly straightforward. It's about this very close relationship between the king, George VI, and his unorthodox speech therapist. And I thought we'd listen to a clip here The king is played by Colin Firth, and the speech therapist Lionel Logue is played by Jeffrey Rush. And this is a moment where they've been working together for some period of time. George VI is now about to be crowned king, and this is a moment where they have cleared out Westminster Abbey so that they can rehearse and this king can confront the task of making a few remarks upon the occasion of his coronation. And they get into an argument, and I'll just mention it makes it easier for the clip if we note that there's a point at which the therapist, Logue, has the effrontery to park his seat in the chair where monarchs sit, and we'll hear that. And what really begins the argument is the king is frustrated and fearful and angry about this situation, and he also has discovered that Lionel Logue is not a doctor and is essentially self-taught. Let's listen.
No training, no diploma, no qualifications, just a great deal of nerve.
Lock me in the tower.
I would, if I could.
On what charge?
Fraud. With war looming, you've saddled this nation with a voiceless king. You've destroyed the happiness of my family, all for the sake of ensnaring a star patient you couldn't possibly hope to assist. It'll be like mad King George III. It'll be mad King George the Stammerer, who let his people down so badly in their hour of need. What are you doing? Get up! You can't sit there! Get up!
Why not? It's a chair.
No, that is not a chair. That is St. Edward's chair.
People have carved their names on it.
Chair is the seat on which every king in
your life... I don't care how many royal arseholes have sat on this chair.
Listen to me! Listen to me!
Listen to you? By what right?
By divine right, if you must. I'm your king.
No, you're not. You told me so yourself. You said you didn't want it. Why should I waste my time listening to you?
Because I have a right to be, and I have a voice!
Yes, you do.
And that's Jeffrey Rush and Colin Firth from The King's Speech, directed by our guest, Tom Hooper. You could hear Colin Firth and his playing a royal with a stutter. He has to get this just right. He can't overdo it. Tell us about developing his character.
I think the inspiration for his performance for both of us was the real king. And we found this wonderful bit of archive footage on the Pathé news site, which I think is available on their public site. From the
one in Glasgow,
Empire Exhibition, 1938. And, you know, try as the newsreel people can to cut away from Bertie. So they cut from his close-up to, you know, spectators in the crowd. They cut to fluttering flags. They cut to chimney pots rather randomly. Whenever they come back in this profile close-up to the king, you can see in his eyes this longing. He just wants to get it right. That's all he wants to achieve. And he keeps getting caught in these horrible, painful silences in which he drowns. And he stops himself and gathers himself and tries again and gets caught and drowns in silence. And it's so moving that by the end of this 3 or 4 minute clip, I had tears in my eyes. And Colin and I saw this and were both hugely moved. And I'm not sure how aware Colin is, but I think he's kind of in an extraordinary way bottled the essence of the real king's stammer.
King George VI, of course, led his nation during World War II and was an important inspirational figure for his people and had to give all these speeches on the radio. And it's interesting that he was confronted with this challenge of conquering his stutter in some respects because of technology, right? I mean, 30 years before or after, he wouldn't have had such an issue, would he?
No, I mean, what's extraordinary about the whole drama of this story derives from the advent of this new medium, this new mass communication medium called radio. Because before the advent of radio, a king was a visual icon. I mean, as long as he could wave from a carriage, look good on a horse, look good in uniform, he could perform the theatrical duty of being a king, which was principally, I would say, in terms of mass iconography, visual. And with the coming of radio, suddenly a king was required to to speak, to connect, and therefore to be effectively an actor. So you have this guy, you know, who's the younger brother who has no expectation of being king. You know, his older brother gives up the throne to marry the American Wallace Simpson. He has a terrible stammer and becomes king right at the moment when this medium has taken off. And, you know, his audience is not just in England. You know, Britain still has 58 countries in the empire, so it's a vast, you know, emergent global audience. You know, and he can't speak. And even more ironically, it's that, you know, 10, 15-year window when it was only a live medium. I mean, you could not pre-record, you could not edit. So you couldn't cheat the stammers out. He had to be a live performance.
When he gave these wartime speeches, was this speech therapist Lionel Logue in the room with him? Was the only one in the room?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we can tell from the diaries, is that, you know, Lionel Logue was in the room one-on-one with the king for I think pretty much all the you know, the wartime speeches. And you know, one of the other great thing about the diaries is it reveals what lies behind, you know, famous imagery. So, for example, it was my birthday recently, and my sister gave me a copy of The Times from the 4th of September 1939, so the day after war's been declared. Now, it being England, and we're an understated nation, news of the outbreak of the Second World War made page 8 of The Times. And on page 8, there's a big half-page picture of King George VI in his full naval uniform at this grand, ornate desk, with these ornate microphones his father used, in a very grand and gilt room, giving the speech that we see at the end of our movie, which is basically the speech he made when war was declared. But we know from the diaries that this is not true. He made it in a special room that Logue set up, which he decorated to make it look cheerful, with an old school desk that Logue had rescued from the basement of Buckingham Palace, you know, which he'd hammered wooden stilts on to raise it up, and the king did it standing up with his jacket off, with the window open, with Logue in the room, one-on-one. And, you know, I now know that that image, that famous image of him giving the speech, is complete nonsense. It's a fabrication, it's a piece of propaganda. And that's what, what's so lovely about the diaries is not only did it give us some flavour of their dialogue and their relationship, but it also, you know, gave me these wonderful physical clues with which to get behind, you know, the surface of the monarch at that time.
So the world knew that King George VI struggled with the speech impediment, but knew that he had managed to overcome that and give these speeches. And what this story really tells us now, it sort of unmasks this close collaborator, this man Lionel Logue, the speech therapist. Tell us just a little bit about him.
Well, he was older than the king, and he was kind of someone, you know, who grew up, you know, basically being fascinated by the voice. So he was born in Adelaide, but moved early in his life to Perth, where he married.
He's Australian.
He's Australian, yeah. In Perth, he taught elocution in schools. He recited Shakespeare and Dickens. He acted a little bit. I think he taught drama. And when the First World War came, there was this sudden influx of young men returning from the Western Front with speech problems, with post-traumatic stress disorder, with shell shock. And they literally kind of said, Lionel, you're the local guy who knows about speech, so why don't you have a crack at helping these poor young men? And that's what he did. And he basically taught himself through trial and error speech therapy in Perth and developed techniques in order to help these men. And, you know, our film suggests that what he felt was these young men, you know, had lost faith in their voice, and he was giving them the right to be heard again, you know, to talk about their trauma and to find their voice again. And he went to England, I think it was 1923 or 24, and he went because, I think on the encouragement of his wife, because he felt that, you know, London was probably where it was at in terms of speech therapy, and so, you know, he should go and find out more about it. And I think they went not intending to live there, but they ended up staying, and he ended up setting up a practice in Harley Street and landing the biggest client of his life.
Right. And of course, it's actually King George's wife, who's played in the film by Helena Bonham Carter, who comes and visits Lionel Logue. One of the things that you see in his methods is that he believes it's not a matter simply of mechanics, that there is a psychological basis for this, and he invades the king's royal privacy by asking questions about what happened to him in his childhood. What do we know about the origins of King George's stutter?
What we know is that he had a very tough childhood. I mean, his parents were very absent. I mean, it's worth pointing out that children of that class, you know, aristocratic children, the norm was you would be brought down at tea time every day and prayed in front of your parents for half an hour, and that was kind of the relationship as a very young kid. You're basically your mother by nannies. But the nanny, you know, who he had very early on in life, was absolutely in love with David, his older brother, and didn't like him. I mean, not only didn't like him, but neglected him and, you know, didn't feed him enough and caused him, you know, stomach problems, which led to, you know, him to having ulcers and being invalided out of the army during the First World War. So, I mean, what I know about stammering, and a lot of this comes from David, the writer who had this stammer, was that when as a young child you lose the confidence that anyone wants to listen to you. You know, so you've got parents who aren't interested and you've got a nanny who loves your older brother and isn't interested. You lose confidence in your voice and you lose confidence in the right to speak. And a lot of the therapy is about saying you have a right to be heard and people should bloody well listen.
Tom Hooper directed the film The King's Speech, which is nominated for 12 Academy Awards. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new Liam Neeson thriller, Unknown. This is Fresh Air. Liam Neeson stars in the new thriller, Unknown, as a man whose identity essentially vanishes into thin air after he's injured in a car crash. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Liam Neeson has his share of triumphs as a serious actor, but after the 2008 thriller Taken was a worldwide smash, every studio wanted to see him with a gun or knife or any available lethal shard, taking out hordes of scummy thugs. You know Schindler's List? Now, meet Schindler's Fist. It's easy to see why he's so compelling in thrillers. He's tall and lean and still, at 58, unbelievably handsome, but with a haggard intensity, a quality of emotional helplessness, even at his most physically resourceful. In Taken, his motivation was to get his kidnapped daughter back, and that's what he did, in a clean, straight line, obliterating anyone in his way without a wasted motion. An action filmmaker needs only to put him on screen, establish the premise, and let her rip. We're with him from the first shot of Unknown, as he stares soulfully at puffy clouds through an airplane window. He and that sleek blonde January Jones are Dr. Martin and Elizabeth Harris, and they're heading to Berlin for a big deal biotech conference. But when they arrive at their Tony Hotel, he discovers the cab driver left one of his bags at the airport and leaps into another taxi, this one driven by dishy German actress Diane Kruger, here playing a Slavic immigrant, and Martin tells her to step on it, and she takes a bad turn, and there's a bridge and a river. And 4 days later, Martin awakes in a hospital with no ID and finds that no one has been looking for him. After signing himself out against his doctor's wishes, he talks security into letting him into the conference's gala ball to find his wife.
Excuse me, madam. Your husband is here.
Liz. Oh, Jesus.
Excuse me. Do I know you?
What's wrong? I'm sorry. I was in an accident. I was in a coma. They didn't know who I was.
Well, you must have me confused with someone else.
Liz. It's me. Martin. Your husband.
This is a misunderstanding. I don't know this man. This is my husband.
You are Dr. Martin Harris?
Last time I looked. Yep, still me.
What's going on here? Is this some kind of a joke?
You know this man?
No.
Who the hell are you?
Who the hell are you?
I'm her husband.
That was Aidan Quinn looking smarmy as the so-called real Dr. Martin Harris. January Jones, meanwhile, is always so blank, it's hard to tell what's going on in Liz's head. And here's where any discussion of Unknown is tricky. Is this an amnesia story, which means this guy only thinks he's Martin, despite what we saw in the early scenes? Is it a brain drain sci-fi, like Total Recall, or a virtual reality mind bender, like Inception? Is he dreaming? Is he dead but doesn't know it? Is that really his wife or a lookalike? Has he been set up by conspirators? Was the taxi driver who's disappeared in on it? Does any of this have to do with the biotechnology conference and its sponsor, a prince from some unnamed Middle Eastern country? Unknowns, unknowns. Pretty soon I got the sense that Unknown's makers were boxing themselves into a corner, and any resolution would be a giant letdown. Well, there is a letdown, but not a giant one. Certainly not enough to keep Unknown from being a hell of a great ride. The Spanish director, Jaume Collet Serra, keeps the movie lean and fast and endlessly upending. And unlike most modern crash-and-bash action directors, he stages fisticuffs and car chases you can actually follow. They're full of neat spatial gags, like the shot in which two cars, one pursued, one pursuing, make a high-speed hairpin turn in perfect synchronization, or the Hitchcockian cat-and-mouse prowl through an art gallery amid giant photos of old women's faces. Unknown also has two marvelous turns by old pros. Bruno Ganz is a detective whom Martin hires, an ex-East German Stasi officer who's proud of his past and his reputation as a detail man. We end up rooting for totalitarian ingenuity. Then the grave and wickedly understated Frank Langella shows up as a colleague of Martin's from America to sort out the mess and make a lot more. My only quibble? Neeson takes too long to stop running away from people who want to kill him and start wasting them. But when he rises to the occasion, it's a mighty moment. That's the part of Unknown that's a known and unbeatable quantity.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.